I was ordained a number of years back after seminary, and ordination is like the pastor's bar exam kind of an experience. And I was preparing for my ordination exam, and I was talking to my pastor, John MacArthur, who's like a famous Bible scholar guy, on the phone in preparation, trying to get hints. And I said, "So you're going to ask me questions?" And he's not showing any cards. He's, "What are you calling me for?" And I said, "So what kind of questions?" He says, "Oh, it won't be bad, Austin. Don't worry. I'm just going to ask you kind of basic theological questions, go through systematic theology with you. I'll ask you questions like, what is aseity?" I said, "Okay." He's like, "No, I'm asking you. What is aseity? So you're going to ask me that? No, I'm asking you right now." I can't Google while I'm on the phone. I can look it up. And that was the first step in, you know, being put on warning, I think, at church. But I did finally pass the exam after some effort, and I did look up that word. And it's a word I had never heard of, a word that I didn't know, a word that comes from Latin. Aseity means self-existence. And so when we talk about God in a systematic way, we can come up with all kinds of words, omnis and aseity, God's self-existence, God's ever-present nature, God's all-knowing nature. But I think the best way to tackle learning about God is to look at a particular portion of Scripture. And I know you'll agree with me in that sense, because this is a church that loves the Bible and loves to hear the Bible taught and expounded and explained. And there is a particular chapter that I want to share with you in the Bible that talks all about God's all-presence, God's all-knowledge, and gives you really an understanding of the omnis that's based and rooted in Scripture. So will you open your Bible to Psalm 139? Psalm 139, and I would like to begin by reading it to you, a psalm that's been called the crown of the Psalter by people who have studied the Psalms. It's well known to you, I'm sure, but let me read it so you're familiar with it. It says, "To the choir master, a psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you form my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them all. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." The attributes of God ask the question, who is God? But I'd like to start somewhere closer to home and ask you a question. Who are you? Who are you? Could be answered variously. You could identify yourself as your present occupation in life. I'm a salesman. I'm a retired police officer. I run a small business. That's how you could define yourself. You could define yourself by the season of life you're in. I'm a student. I'm in summer school. I'm single. Hint, hint. I'm engaged. I'm newly married. We have lots of young kids. Our kids are getting older. We're empty nesters. I'm a senior citizen. Who are you? Could be your career that defines you or your stage of life. Maybe it's your political affiliation. You could identify yourself as a son, a daughter, a friend, a statistic, a demographic, a Hispanic, a Norwegian. Maybe you're a Bruin or a Trojan. There's a lot of those where I'm from. Are you a consumer, a constituent? Are you a fan? Are you on Facebook? If you're on Facebook, you can click on things that you identify with. I clicked on one kid, and he was identifying himself as a fan of rain, Oreos, staying up late, fire, not being on fire, Pau Gasol, Taco Bell, you can fix anything with duct tape, yelling at inanimate objects, what? Sliding on wood floors in socks. Wouldn't it be ironic if you choked on a lifesaver? This one's saying like every other word isn't my fault. It's my Californian accent. Who are you? How do you identify yourself? Or does all this talk make you feel like a statistic, a number? Psalm 139 answers the question, who are you, from a radically different perspective? A perspective more accurate than you may be ready for this morning. A perspective that comes from the crown of the psalm, Psalm 139, I really think unequaled in the theological depth that it covers. And this psalmist wants us to know the all-knowing God, the God who knows us, the God who knows everything. But we find out that this psalm isn't just a generic, systematic approach to the knowledge of God hypothetically. This is a psalm that talks about theology in a very practical way. Because we find out in this song that the key to finding out who you are is knowing who God is. David wants us to know God. And so he pens this ancient song so that we would know God and know ourselves. Famous theologian John Calvin wrote this: nearly all the wisdom we possess, that is to say, true and sound wisdom, consists of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. So Psalm 139 teaches us just that. It teaches us who God is and teaches us things we must know about God and informs us on who we are and teaches us how to live in light of God's omniscience, in light of God's omnipotence, in light of God's omnipresence. Because who we are is defined in our relationship to Him. And there is no more important or foundational issue than who God is. Because we can answer who we are many different ways. But you can answer who God is one way savingly and many ways fatally. And so it's of great importance that we know who God is. This is a familiar song. I told you that. There's a famous poem written by Francis Thompson, The Hound of Heaven, based on this song. There's contemporary Christian music that spans throughout ages of the church that are based on this song, particularly on some of the most comforting verses here. It's a beautifully crafted song, a familiar song, a beloved song. But there's something we often miss in this song, and I want to tell you about it at the outset. there is an underlying sense of discomfort, something that comes from recognizing God's overwhelming presence. When you come to realize the extent to which God knows everything, but not just everything, the extent to which God knows you, it begins to challenge your thinking and challenge your actions, because it's simultaneously comforting and unsettling, because God knows you completely. The speaker acknowledges God's greatness, but is bothered in some sense by the impossibility of escaping his towering presence. And so let's listen to Psalm 139 together, a message I've titled, "The God Who Knows You." The God Who Knows You. And I call it that because this word "know" is key to unlocking this psalm. The word "know" or knowledge occurs six times in Psalm 139, verse 1, verse 2, verse 4, verse 6, verse 14, and verse 23. You can find that word "know" even in your English translation. It's there. And this psalm is all about knowledge. And so let's work through it as the song flows, first looking at verses 1 through 6. Verses 1 through 6, God's inexhaustible knowledge of you. God's inexhaustible knowledge of you. I know you're used to a PowerPoint, and I apologize. I've abandoned PowerPoint for a more old-school version. This is my PowerPoint. So, just mix it up a little bit. So, point one, God's inexhaustible knowledge of you. We see this in verses 1 through 6. Listen to how he begins. "O Lord," all caps, it's the name Yahweh, God's covenant name. "O Yahweh, you have searched me and known me." You see, God's awareness of you is without qualification. It's without qualification. "Yahweh, you have searched me and known me." He simply declares it to be a fact because it is. "You know me because you've searched me," he says. The knowledge of God that the psalmist describes, a God who searches and knows in this way, is hard to comprehend. How does God know you? How much does he know you? Answer, his knowledge of you is inexhaustible. First of all, we see this knowledge is personal. Psalm 139 is a psalm about you in many ways. Look at what it says. I'm not trying to be homiletical and make this about you. This psalm is built this way. It says, "You have searched me and known me." When I sit down, when I stand up, my rest, my ways, my tongue, you've encircled me. Throughout this entire psalm, the psalmist keeps referring back to God's knowledge of himself. And so that personal pronoun is there over and over again. This extraordinary knowledge, verse 6, is beyond me. It is lofty. I am unable to reach it. It's incredibly personal. And God's knowledge of us is indeed personal. This is an expression often, Psalm 139 is in the systematic texts to tell us, well, here's an example of God's omniscience. But this isn't just a statement that God knows everything, which is what omniscience means. This is a statement that says God knows you. It's not just that he knows all facts in the universe, all solutions to all math problems, that he knows how big the universe is. All those things are true. This psalm is riveted and focused on God's personal knowledge of you, friend, you personally. And that's the basis of understanding ourselves in light of understanding God. This uninterrupted praise keeps looking back and forth from God to self and self to God. And God's closeness is often taken as a good thing. And we love that truth as Christians. It's a source of comfort in the scriptures. God is accessible to us. He's near to us when we cry out to him. But in this psalm, there's a different tone. The psalmist seems to be bothered, discomforted at God's intensely personal knowledge. His inexhaustible knowledge is personal, but it's also comprehensive. Look at verse 2. "You know when I sit down and when I get up. Even from far away, you understand my motives." My motives. Well, that's an interesting thing to know. He has a deeply personal knowledge, and he also has a completely comprehensive knowledge. "You know when I sit down and when I get up. Even from far away, you understand my motives." Some translations speak of measurement here. My traveling and my lying down, you measure. It's a word that means to span or to measure, but I think the root of that word is a word that means to winnow or to sift. a common word in the Old Testament. It was an agrarian society. We don't do a lot of winnowing and sifting. We simply drive through Starbucks. But in the ancient world, you would have to winnow and sift. You would harvest the grain, and it is useless in its present form, and so it needed to be not only dry and ready for harvest, but it needed to be winnowed, it needed to be sifted, it needed to be processed, and so that grain would be beaten and ground and dealt with until the husk, the chaff would come off, and then the grain would be useful to grind into bread. That's the word at the heart of this understanding of motives. It's that God, as though we are wheat, shakes us up, roughs us up, gets to what's inside of us. He winnows you. What an interesting word. A psalm that's transfixed with this intimate knowledge of God. God is presented as so immense, yet so imminent. Simultaneously infinite in his knowledge, yet intimate in his knowledge. And it simply returns to the fact that God knows all about you. I know this is basic, but look at the action verbs just in these opening verses. Verse 1, you've searched me and known me. Verse 2, you know and understand. Verse 3, you comprehend. That's the word winnow or sifts. And are acquainted with me. You know altogether. Verse 4, you've hemmed, ESV. You've hemmed me in. In verse 5, that's a shocking statement. The NAS says enclosed. The Hebrew word means encircled. It's sometimes translated, you have beset me or encircled me, or you hem me, you've enclosed me. The Net Bible says you've squeezed me in. The NJB says you fenced me in. It's a word used in the book of Deuteronomy, in the book of 2 Samuel, in the book of Jeremiah, for armies that surround a town to besiege it. And David takes that word, a military word he'd be very familiar with, and applies it to the way God looks at him. It's hard to get away from God. How comprehensive is his knowledge? He's got you surrounded. And so his knowledge is personal. It's entirely comprehensive. The things you do, whether passive or active, laying down or standing up, it's all covered. This is how comprehensive his knowledge is. It includes your deeds and your words and your thoughts. That's what he says in these opening verses. How comprehensive is God's knowledge? Well, look at your deeds. Passive things like sitting and resting and standing up. And then more active things like standing up and traveling. And then your words are included too in verse 3. He knows what you say before you speak. How can that be? That's because God's personal knowledge includes your thoughts. He knows your thoughts from far away. It exceeds anyone else's knowledge of you. His scrutiny of your most intimate thoughts and desires. A total knowledge of things you don't even know about yourself. He knows you. God knows you inside and out. He has exhaustive knowledge of you. He knows all your actions, all your conduct, the things you do, sitting, rising. He knows everything you've ever done or ever will do. He is well acquainted with you. He knows your heart, your character. This is both convicting and comforting, is his exhaustive knowledge of you. He knows your actions, verses 2 and 3, laying stress upon you, sitting down, rising up. It's a Hebrew way of saying inclusive of everything you do, from the time you rise up to the time you lay down. All your activities are completely familiar to God. You comprehend, you winnow my path, you know my motives. My lying down, acquainted with all my ways. God knows you personally, and God knows you thoroughly. And at times we are self-deceived, but God knows us better than we know ourselves. Even our attitudes and motives behind actions are often unknown to us, but not to God. He discerns or understands our thoughts from afar off. Our motives may be mixed. We may not be sure what motivation we have for getting up and coming to church today and shoving the kids in the van and everything else, but God does. He knows exactly why you do what you do. And he knows why you say what you say, and he knows what you don't say in verse 4. God knows your conversation, both public and secret. When you talk to yourself in the car, he hears it all. You're on the 15 freeway, we see you talking to yourself, singing to yourself. God knows what you said. Even before you say it, he knows the word is altogether in verse 4. He knows where you've been and where you're going, verses 5 and 6. He has you surrounded, hemmed in, enclosed, encircled, yes, by his love and care, but it's a military word. And I think David chooses it on purpose because this inescapable knowledge of God is starting to weird David out. He's starting to feel this heavy presence of God all around him as he comes to terms with the intimacy of God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. You hedge me before and behind. You lay your hand on me is one way to translate verse 7. You've encircled me to protect or to keep safe would be included, but to besiege and to confine. He has you surrounded. He has you hemmed in. This speaks of his protection, but this could equally speak of his judgment. I mean, think about the person who knows you best. Your husband. Your wife. And think about how their knowledge of you has grown. Or if a young person, your mom or your dad. And when you were born, little guy, we didn't know who you were. We held you up and gave you a name and got to know you. If you got a number of kids, you're able to say, you know, this one's got this kind of temperament. This one, I'm not sure, is totally related. This one, you know, you kind of go through it and see. We have dozens of children at my house. I think it's 4, but I lost track after 3. And we know them, and you know your spouse, and you know how do you know them? It's because of all this time you spent. Remember, before you were married, you used to talk on the phone for 12 hours. Remember that? Probably don't do that anymore. You've grown in your knowledge of each other, and that's because there's a relationship between knowledge and love. And God knows it all, exhaustively and completely. How do I know he loves me and cares for me? Because he's laid his hand upon me, verse 5. The child of God is clearly in view here. You've placed your hand on me. Positively, that means a hand of blessing and loving care. But negatively, for God to place his hand on you in the Old Testament meant pressure and God's chastisement and judgment. Do you see how this psalm is looking both at amazing intimacy for the believer, but a tremendous, heavy, frightening presence of God as determined by your lack of relationship with him. The word verse 6, wonderful, is emphatic at the sentence at the beginning, strengthening the idea, saying this is surpassing, this is wonderful. I try to reach it, but I can't totally grasp it. God is dug down, winnowing into the fiber of your being, digging down deeply to uncover the truth about you. And David says, you know me because you dug down deeply inside of me. This is not mere data for systematic theology. This is not so you can win your Awana badge and knock off the attributes of God on your list. This is saying that God knows all things. And this is saying that God knows all things about you. That's why he says, me, me, my. There's no formal theological points here. It's highly personal. It's intimate, deep words and thoughts. He scrutinizes you. Those things that you would do anything in your power to prevent from being publicly accessible, those things that you would use all your strength to conceal about yourself, God knows those things. He knows them completely. Maybe this is creeping you out. Good. I think that's where David is too. Because David is a person like you. A person who lived after the fall of man. A person whose heart is influenced by sin. A person who made bad decisions. A person who sought to honor God but didn't always do that. David understands this and he knows how you're feeling. He wrote this poem so that you would understand how God thinks about you. That you wouldn't fool yourself into some Lysol'd version of God. This is what God is like. There's no privacy. There's no confidentiality agreement. He's not concerned about your rights, your privileges. There's no place that is apart from his access. There's no private setting on this web browser. There's nothing about you that he doesn't know. God, in a sense, knows you better than you know yourself. How does that make you feel? Joy? Security? Guilt? Peace? Divine omniscience is beyond our comprehension. Listen to Tozer. He's a mixed bag, but I'll read him here. How unutterably sweet is the knowledge that our Heavenly Father knows us completely. No talebearer can inform on us. No enemy can make an accusation stick. No forgotten skeleton can come tumbling out of some hidden closet to abash us and expose our past. No unsuspecting weakness in our characters can come to light to turn God away from us, since He knew us utterly before we knew Him and called us to Himself in the full knowledge of everything that was against us. That's helpful. And so that is a reminder of God's awesome, powerful, inescapable understanding of who you are. That's the omnis of God made quite personal in those opening six verses. But He goes deeper still. Look with me at verses 7 through 12. Let's call this God's inescapable presence with you. God's inescapable presence with you. Verses 7 through 12. He begins by saying, where can I go to escape from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, the place of the dead, the grave, you are there. If I live at the eastern horizon or settle at the western limits, even there your hand will lead me. Your right hand will hold on to me. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night shines like the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. See how this isn't mere theological extrapolation about the omnis? He wants to escape. He feels oppressed by this knowledge. He's simultaneously struck with wonder and amazement, and he thinks about God's presence and asks an obvious question. What would it take to run? What would it take to get out of this? Verses 8 and 9 use two pairs of hypothetical opposites, which include everything in between them. You go up to heaven, God is there. You make your resting place in Sheol, the grave, the place of the dead, and guess who's there? God. You're up, you're down, you're everywhere in between. You cannot escape His searching gaze. This beautiful poetic imagery that David employs by saying, if I take the wings of the morning and go to the east at the speed of light, if I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, the west, the Mediterranean, you are there too. It's saying the east to the west, the polar opposites, where the sun rises and where it sets. This is the penetrating nature of God's gaze into who you are. It's invasive, it's intrusive, and He's not respecting your space. What do you say to that? Maybe you're wondering, is this really biblical? I mean, is this like your kind of take on Psalm 139? Listen to Job. Tell me this isn't the same kind of sentiment. Job 7, it says this. What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him, that you visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? That's in the Bible, junior hires. If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be. Job, he's feeling the same feeling. In his trial, in his difficulty, he feels God's heavy hand on him. You know, the encouragement here is that a fallen human being can never be fully comfortable in the presence of a perfectly holy, omniscient God. And that's a good thing. That's why this extraordinary knowledge in verse 6 is beyond me. He's unable to reach it, and his awareness of you is unqualified. Verses 7 through 12 tell us God's presence with you is inescapable. The reason he knows you so well is that he's always with you. He uses this word, your presence. It's the Hebrew word for face. He's saying, where can I escape from your face? A symbolic way, an anthropomorphic way of talking about the presence of God. The inference here is that you can't. Inference one, you can't escape from his face. And inference two is that we are runners by nature. When sin broke in on God's perfect garden, what did Adam do? He took off and hid. And this is what sinful man does. So we look to hypothetical locations to escape, up or down, east or west, the verse 9, to the eastern horizon, the wings of the dawn, a beautiful figure of speech. If I rise in the wings of the dawn. Well, what is this, the equivalent, modern equivalent of the saying? It's less poetic, but, you know, God's faster than the speed of life, the speed of light and life. 186,000 miles per second. I said this in my college group, 186 miles per hour. I was just talking fast, and like 400 nerds came up to me afterwards and like, that's so slow. It's per second. The irony that I have the spiritual oversight of so many math majors is one of heaven's great jokes. 186 miles per second. You can't travel fast enough to get away from God. If I make my home in the far part of the sea, he says, the western border of Israel, the Mediterranean, cross it, go to the other side, still not beyond the reach of God's grasp. Remember, Jonah tested this and found it to be true. Verse 11, even in your right hand, if I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night. Oh, what's this talking about? If I make myself invisible, surely the darkness will hide me, he says. But that doesn't work either, because darkness and light are alike to us. In verse 12, alike to him, not alike to us. In the darkness, we stub our toe in the kitchen. In the light, we can make our way around. Not to God, like darkness, like light is what it says in Hebrew. It's a little idiomatic expression, like darkness, like light. We say, like father, like son. I have a little son. His name's Owen Duke Duncan. And if you shaved his head, same, like father, like son. Chubby face, blue eyes, same deal. Like father, like son. To God, like darkness, like light. It's no difference to him. That doesn't slow him down. There's no hiding from him. No difference between the way to God, between the two to God. Those of you involved, by the way, and there are some of you involved in secret sin. If you're involved in secret sin, do you recognize this? Do you think like this? Or do you think that you've planned it right, that you've covered it up? Because you fooled your parents or you fooled your spouse, you're safe. Because nobody found out about it. It's just you in the exam, it's just you in the tax form, it's just you in the computer. David exposes that whole thing as a lie. Where can I go? You are there. This is not a generic statement about the omnipresence of God. It's about you, 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 each one of you, and a holy God. To know that you can never be cut off from the presence of God, to be like Jonah and to literally try to escape over the sea. Some of you are hiding Jonah-like from God. All these questions of a positive affirmation of God's presence. David realizing, I'll never be cut off from the presence of God. Escaping and fleeing and hiding, all these words he uses, I can't get away from his grasp. You may be determined to do your own thing, but no man can hide from God. There are no real fugitives from God's presence. You can run and run and run, and he's there with you. You know, this is a great help to us. If you've prayed for the salvation of a lost person for a long time, maybe somebody who knows the truth, who was raised in the church, knows the gospel, and you've prayed for them for a long time, and they keep running and keep running, and they run continually into the presence of God. They can't escape him. And so our prayers are fueled, right? We could pray for that person because we know God can reach him. God's there. They can't do anything to get away from him. They can't go anywhere to be out of his grasp. There is no true prodigal in that sense because you can't run from God. The next section speaks of the impossibility of escaping God. It makes it clear that the speaker is uncomfortable. Where can I escape from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Verse 7, it's this word, where. Wherever he goes, God is there. And so let's look at this next section. It's verses 13 through 18. It's God's intimate creation of you. God's intimate creation of you. Sum it up this way: He owns you and you belong to Him. Look at verses 13 and 14. For it was you who created my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I will praise you because I've been remarkably and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful and I know this very well. My bones were not hidden from you, verse 15. When I was made in secret, when I formed from the depths of the earth, your eyes saw me when I was formless. All my days were written in your book and planned before a single one of them began. God, how difficult your thoughts are for me to comprehend, how vast their sum is. If I counted them, they would outnumber the grains of the sand. When I wake up, I am still with you. You who created me, David says, you who knit me together, you saw me. You saw me when I was just little. This is not merely a biological statement, though this verse is rightly used by Christians everywhere to remind us that personhood exists before birth and that abortion is an unspeakably evil crime against God, that there is no such definition as a non-person in the womb. That's disproven by this verse, but that's not David's main point here. He looks at God and looks at the creation of himself in his mother's womb and sees it like a potter making a vessel or a master weaver. Both of those words are used, fashioning them together in the mother's womb. A perfect combo. God made you is what this says. God made you. And remember that God makes no mistakes. I'm saying that to every single one of you, and David affirms this to be true. God made you and God makes no mistakes. He crafted you. He gave you your limitations, both physical and intellectual, and we all have those. He made you on purpose, and that's true whether you're an Olympian or whether you're severely disabled. God made you. He made you on purpose. He created you, and God makes no mistakes. And so David looks at his own creation and says, I'm remarkably, meaning it causes astonishment, and he worships God's creative activity, and I'm wonderfully, this is beyond all human powers, no matter what advancement science can make, they'll never make the soul of man, they'll never make a person, and they'll never invent what God invented when he invented mankind in his image. Verse 14, he says, your works are wonderful, and I know this very well, exceedingly well. This is the same words of Genesis 1 in the creation narrative when he says he made it, and it was very good. It's a word that means exceedingly good, very well, not just good. The same kind of language of creation David applies to this womb with a view. Womb with a view, that's cheesy. But he looks like a tapestry, like a beautiful tapestry, or like a vessel made by a skilled potter, and says, God made me like that. In the depths of the earth, verse 15, a metaphor for the dark interior of the mother's womb. And that's one of the best things about being a dad, right? Watching a wife transform into a pregnant woman with all her strange desires. For pickles or just for deliverance. And right? And you see a little twitch in there, just a little twitch on the belly, right? And then it transforms into a mixed martial arts exhibition in there, kicking and fighting its way. And that's awesome. And we see, you know, that from the outside, and then we have pictures a doctor gives us that look like aliens, and, you know, technology gets better, and it looks a little bit more babyish, but that's the scariest baby I've ever seen. I mean, give me the best 4D you got, still kind of scary. But there's a view that God sees in verse 16, and it's perfect. He sees the unformed substance. In your book were written every one of my days, were formed for me when there was none of them. It's amazing. With a plan and a purpose, before a single day began, God brought you into being. He put you together. He scheduled and planned a number of days in his agenda and purpose. And David says, how vast is your thoughts? How vast is the sum of them? They outnumber the grains of sand. When I wake up, he says, sleep makes no sense in the context here. Sleep here is a euphemism for death.
When I wake up in the resurrection, you personally fashion my existence. He's talking about his very beginning as a tiny baby in the womb to the very end of his life when he'll be raised from the grave. He's talking about the full span of life. You schedule all my days, the end of my days. I'm still with you, every single one of them. You're watching over me. You have me in your hand like it always was, like it always will be. I ask you again, is this a good thing or is this terrifying? Ultimately, it depends on your relationship to him, doesn't it? The presence of God, does it cause you comfort or anxiety? Joy or trauma? Confidence or fear? It's ultimately determined by your present relationship with God. Do you know him? Because he clearly knows you. From the womb to the grave, the speaker is praising God for creating him, employing this strange and fascinating concept of the Genesis story weaved in with the creation of a baby in the womb. And he talks about, verse 13, certainly made my mind and heart. You wove me together in my mother's womb. Speaking of the heart there, the mind, the heart. The heart is the Hebrew word for heart, used just like our word for heart. The word mind is the word kidneys, and you may think Hebrew people are weird, but we say all kinds of weird stuff like you have my heart in your hands, and we don't actually mean chunk, 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 chunk. So it's just a metaphor. I just mentioned that because your Bible note probably says it. The kidneys were seen as the seed of emotions and moral character and the conscience, and that makes sense because when you sin, when you have a soft conscience, you feel it down in you, don't you? That's God's way of reminding you that there's a guidance system in you called your conscience. The Hebrews called it, and it's like your kidneys. And he says, God, verse 13, you made my conscience and my heart. You wove me together in my mother's womb. This is what Jeremiah said. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Jeremiah 1:4. Again, this word you is emphatic all through here. My soul knows this very well. Verse 14, he has no doubts about the creator or the tiny creation here. This human life is very clear to David. He's reminded that God has always known him and always will know him. And then this psalm brings itself to a close in verses 19 to 24. And it simply says, you must respond appropriately. 19 to 24, you must respond appropriately. What is your response to God's all-searching knowledge of you? Well, he tells you how to respond here. So merciful that God's revelation is so practical. Verse 19, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Okay, maybe you weren't ready for that. This psalm takes an unexpected turn, doesn't it, in verse 19. I mean, we know this psalm because we sing things like, search me, O God, and know my heart. I'm not a singer, I'm a preacher. And know my heart, right? We sing songs like that. Or, you know, see if there be any wicked way in me. Okay, you know, there's nice songs. It usually doesn't have, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. It just seems to be some, like at least a sharp turn in the song there, right? Verse 19, it's an unexpected turn. Some liberal scholars look at this and say, clearly this was done by an insensitive editor. What editor would be that insensitive? I mean, clearly there's something happening here. There's a key to understanding this psalm with this sharp turn in verse 19 where he says, God, if only you would kill the wicked. You bloodthirsty men, stay away from me who invoke you deceitfully. Your enemies swear by you falsely. Lord, don't I hate those who hate you and detest those who rebel against you. I hate them with extreme hatred. I consider them my enemies. What's happening here? This unexpected turn that this song takes that asks God to do away with these previously unmentioned evil ones or wicked ones is really an expression of his allegiance to God. You see, a right response to God's omnis, to his omniscience, his omnipresence, to his all-searching eye, the right response to this is that you would have the right allegiance, the right loyalty. And so David explains this in terms that make great sense in the Old Testament context. He says, God, if you'd only kill the wicked, you bloodthirsty men, stay away from me. David was a man of war. He was at war. He understood exactly what was happening around him. There were people who were out to kill him, and much of that was due to God's judgment on those people. And David was God's chosen man, and God promises he will deal with the wicked. And David expresses that to express his allegiance to God. So when we're talking about this omniscient God, the question is are you loyal to him? Can you handle a God like this? Or do you prefer to create a God in your own imagination, an idolatrous kind of conception of God? Who is your God? Because the only God there is in the universe is a God of all-searching omniscience who knows you completely, who has made demands on your life because he created you and because he owns you, and God will deal with the wicked. So are you with them or are you with God? And so David prays to God, deal with the wicked. This is a powerful prayer. A great, a good, a just, a righteous God. Nothing beyond his knowledge or power. Nothing beyond his presence. We see his power in this psalm displayed so clearly. And then David prays this prayer of imprecation. A psalm calling on God to judge the wicked, to slay the wicked. And David says, I'm with you. I'm not with your enemies. I want to be on your side. You know, the Bible declares clearly that God will one day judge the secrets of every heart. And that secret sins will never remain secret. That all secrets will be disclosed openly before the throne of God. And all sin is an assault on a holy God, whether done in public or in secret. And God, who knows you and knows your sin and knows your secrets, is not fooled when you cover it up. You see, the term omnipresence is borrowed from the Latin meaning all, omni meaning all, and presence meaning here. In other words, God is always here. He knows you completely. He knows everything about you. And his omniscience is so searching and so strong and so powerful that you need to know you are either for him or you are against him. And David clearly expresses that he is in total allegiance to God, verse 19. The wicked, the bloodthirsty, he will not be aligned with them. This is how Jesus was in his zeal for God. It ate him up. You know, there's two warnings here. You have to be careful with a verse like 19. You have to be careful not to assume that your enemies are God's enemies. But I think you also need to be careful not to assume that he has no enemies. The oppressors, the unrighteous, if they are your enemies and by virtue of your relationship to God, you must love him, and there must be loyalty to him and devotion to him. And he learned this, David learned this from God himself, the covenant God of Israel, who declared his allegiance to his people. I will be a foe to your foes. He responds like God responds. His awareness of you is inducing this fear and this reality that your loyalty must be to God and to God alone. It has to be total allegiance and then with total submission. Listen to these words. Search me, verse 23, and know my heart. There's evil outside and there's evil within. And David lays himself wide open before the all-searching eye of God. You ever have surgery? Sean Furrow was probably in the room selling the doctor a bunch of stuff. But you ever had surgery? It's not something you want to have. You know, they cut you wide open. Not really a desirable thing, is it? Unless it's going to save your life. And then sign me up. Right? Well, David asks for open heart surgery here. He says, search me and know me. Open me wide up. And it's in order for his life to be saved. He wants to be continually led. He wants to have all this prior anxiety about the omniscience of God be opened up before God so that God would see him, God would know him, and he would say, I'm yours, God. He pulls this whole psalm together, having been searched in verse 1. Oh Lord, you've searched me and known me, verse 1. Now he ends with, search me, oh God, an invitation for God to completely look through him, for completely watch over him, to own him completely. Know my heart, try me, and know my thoughts. thoughts. David doesn't want to hide one more day from God. He doesn't want to hide one more thing from God. He wants to belong to God and to God alone. And he says, see if there be any grievous way in me. He wants all the sin confessed. He wants it all open before God. He doesn't care what anyone else thinks. He only knows that God knows him. And so this is between him and between God. And he knows that the only way for him to be clean in God's presence and to be acceptable to God is that God would lead him on a road to eternal life. Verse 24b, and lead me in the way everlasting. You see, David wants you to follow the God who follows you, to know the God who knows you. And the fullest revelation of this God is in the person of Jesus Christ. And he is the ever-present one. He sits at the right hand of God the Father. He is the creating one. He is the resurrected one. And he knows you. And he too has a fierce loyalty. And he would say, he hates those who hates God and loves those who loves God. And you see, the sweetness of surrender to the omniscient God this morning is to say to Jesus Christ, you have access to all of it. All my life, every corner, full confession, full disclosure. Scrutinize my thoughts, desires, my motivations, and cut it all out, and lead me in the way everlasting.